This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hello, everybody. Bob Main here. Welcome to another episode of the Handgun World Show. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. You are listening to a practical show. I'm not a gunsmith. I'm not ex-law enforcement. I'm not ex-military. I'm not even a firearms trainer, folks. I'm just a regular guy. I love to shoot. I love to conceal carry. I strongly believe in the Second Amendment, and that's what you're going to get, an everyday guy's point of view. I was born in New York City, raised in Wisconsin, home of the Super Bowl champion Green Bay Packers. Indulge me, folks. I love saying that. I don't get a chance to say that very often. You'll hear more about that later. But this is not a sports show. Now I live in the great state of Texas, gun-friendly state, and I carry a gun every day for personal protection. So in this show, I got a couple more interviews coming up for you. Primarily, we're going to talk about old guns. Old collectible guns. And a few weeks back, I had Rick Brenneman from the Power Factor show interview with me about collecting guns. He's back. He's going to be one of the people that I have on this show as a guest, talking about part two of some old guns, collectible guns, and a few things that we did not get a chance to cover last time. I'm also going to have Steve Zofi on here, not talking about Brian Enos's book, but talking about how the scoring takes place in a competition match and how the classifications take place. I recently had some people who were more interested in competition shooting email me, and they said, "Hey, Bob, how does it work? How do you get classified? How do they score the targets? How is that ranking system all figured out?" Well, we're going to answer some of those questions for you in this show when I get Steve on here a little bit later. So be ready for that a little bit later in the show. Well, let's go ahead and get started with the first interview. Again, it's Rick Brenneman from the Power Factor Show at www.powerfactorshow.com. It is a show on the Gun Rights Radio Network, and it's a video podcast. So I urge you to watch that because they have a lot of good information on there about shooting techniques. Let's go ahead and get right to it. Just a real quick break, a little bit of a message from the Gun Rights Radio Network, and then Rick Brenneman is going to join me to talk about those old collectible guns. Stay tuned.
It was one of the worst mass murders committed by a single person. It happened down south. A lunatic killed 27 people, including his own mother, in a single pass. The killer used a six-shot revolver and a knife. Mass murderers find whatever tools they need, and those tools don't need to be sporting rifles or high-capacity clips. A slow, reloading revolver is all this fellow needed. Banning clips will not prevent a madman's massacre. But that doesn't matter to the gun control industry, who thinks inanimate objects are evil, but ignore the deranged people who misuse them. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Okay, for this show, I have another guest with me. He's been on here before. I've got Rick Brenneman from Power Factor Show joining me. How you doing, Rick?
Great. Good to be here.
Well, good. Thanks for coming on. His show is powerfactorshow.com. It's a video podcast on the Gun Rights Radio Network. Excellent, excellent show. I've watched 8 or 9 of their episodes so far, and I would strongly recommend that anybody that's into competition shooting, specifically USPSA and IDPA, watch Rick and Steve's show, powerfactorshow.com. I understand you have some experts coming up on your show pretty soon, huh?
Yeah, we do. Steve and I, although we've been shooting for a long time and have a lot of experience, just in terms of match experience and different stuff we've done, neither of us has done a lot of shooting of revolvers, which are somewhat popular in both IDPA and USPSA, and neither of us has any experience really with the open division guns in USPSA.
Yeah.
And so we've scheduled some people people that we consider to be kind of experts or specialists in those divisions, and we'll have them on the show to kind of just fill it out and give it a little more gravitas than if Steve and I were just kind of trying to fake our way through it.
Well, that's cool. Well, I wanted to bring you back on again because the last time we talked about, you know, collectible and accumulating firearms, specifically older guns and things like that, and you had a lot of good points to share with people. I like the fact that you actually shoot what you like to collect, and folks were sending me emails saying they really enjoyed that. So this is going to be kind of a part two. I want to go over some of the same stuff you talked about, but kind of ask you a couple of different questions. Is that okay?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay. You've mentioned before that if people are going to accumulate guns, older guns, that they're going to shoot to try to stay away from some of the obscure calibers. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you've got a lot of military surplus weapons on the market from various countries around the world. And if it's a country that adopted either, especially back in the Cold War, you know, the NATO countries were all issuing 7.62 NATO rifles, 9mm Luger pistols, and the same or the similar situation existed in the Warsaw Pact countries where they either adopted or built their own versions of Soviet weapons. And so there's a certain consistency of cartridges.
Yeah.
And today those are still generally widely available. I mean, they used to be dirt cheap. Those days are probably over. But if you start looking at countries that kind of have their own indigenous arms manufacturing capabilities, they'll sometimes go completely away from some of these kind of standardized cartridges. I mean, like the Swiss, for instance, have insisted pretty much on building their own weapons, and they've had their own calibers and whatnot, and so they'd make some really nice stuff, but if you're looking at a supply of readily available factory ammo as opposed to hand-loaded ammo, you know, I think if you're going to invest some money into a gun that you are going to want to shoot, it makes sense to buy one for which you think there's a sustainable supply of ammo.
And I bet you if you're a reloader, same thing holds true. You want to buy something that's easier to find bullets to reload them, correct?
Well, exactly, and even some obscure calibers will use, for instance, a somewhat standard bullet. I mean, you know, we have our, you know, 308 inch caliber rifle cartridges that are, you know, many different cartridges that use a bullet of that diameter, and so there's always going to be a supply of bullets of that size. But for instance, I was trying to find some pistol bullets that were 0.309 inch in diameter. And, you know, you could say, well, it's only a thousandth of an inch, and that's true. You could load 308-inch bullets, but I just thought, you know, the gun was designed for a 309, actually 309+, and so I ended up sizing down somewhat oversized bullets rather than shoot undersized bullets.
Okay. Makes sense. Well, okay, so give some examples of some of the obscure cartridges you're talking about.
Well, you know, I already mentioned, you know, in terms of surplus weapons, very Swiss cartridges, even modern, some modern service pistol cartridges, you know, I mean, most of the, let's say, military in the U.S., military and police agencies are using either 9mm Luger or 40 Smith & Wesson, and some are using 45, but then some are using, say, 357 SIG, which I would consider, even though it's fairly new cartridge and has made some inroads, I would consider it still a fairly obscure cartridge.
Now, that's interesting because there's two schools of thought. Some people would disagree with you that it's an obscure cartridge, and some think that it is. What's interesting is it's, you know, 357 SIG is very, very popular. I've considered getting a gun for that caliber. It seems like... Well, reloaders seem to hate that cartridge, but right now there seems to be a pretty decent supply of it.
Yeah, I think if you're only going to shoot factory ammo and you're already dependent on a supply of factory ammo and that's all you're going to shoot, it's probably as good as anything. But for the hand loader, I mean, it's really kind of a dead end. The cartridge is not very versatile. It was designed to shoot a specific bullet weight. And the bullets have to be designed, in a sense, they have to be designed specifically for that cartridge because the envelope is just very limited. The case has a very short neck. It has to fit within a gun that's that was originally designed for 9mm Luger or 40 Smith & Wesson. And so just the kind of the envelope of the cartridge dictates that it really doesn't do anything other than what it was designed for, which was to provide a short stroke semi-auto pistol cartridge that mimicked the 357 Magnum revolver cartridge.
Yeah.
And,
well,
you know,
that's a good point. I guess there's some people that would disagree with that. You know, one of the things that I like about pistols chambered in 357 SIG is they can easily be converted to 40 caliber.
Yeah, and I would say that if somebody were to ask me to like list the pros and cons of the 357 SIG, at the top of the pros, I would say it's easily converted to 40 Smith & Wesson.
Yeah, so if the 357 SIG does become very difficult to find at some point, all you got to do is change out barrels and you've got a 40 caliber gun.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I look at the 357 SIG sort of like the 45 Gap. You know, I mean, it's a cartridge that's fairly recently introduced. There seemed to be a little bit of interest in it, but it just doesn't really do anything that really needs a separate cartridge and gun design to do. And so it's already, I think, kind of, you know, fallen out of favor. And the 357 SIG, I mean, I think it's probably riding a wave of popularity right now that I just think isn't going to last. That's why I'd say it's obscure. It's obviously well-known today, but, you know, let's see 20 years from now.
Well, a lot of people sure love its effectiveness and its, you know, so-called stopping power. There seems to be a lot of tests that show that it's very good.
Yeah, I just think that it's just kind of one-dimensional, though. It doesn't really do anything else. It's not going to have any popularity in competition. If you're stuck shooting factory ammo, it's pretty expensive plinker. So, it has its place. I just don't think it's versatile enough that it's going to have much lasting power.
Boy, for competition, you're right. I mean, I would never even think of using 357 SIG in competition just because of the ammo costs, and I'm not a reloader. And like I was mentioning before, even people who are reloaders say that it's just a real bear to try to reload for that cartridge.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
So what about, let's talk about long guns. Let's talk about older long guns for a minute. What do you think of military surplus like Mosin Nagant 7.62 by 54s, guns like, you know, rifles like that?
Well, again, I think I would tie it to the availability of ammo. If you're not, especially if you're not a hand loader and you're dependent on continued supply of ammunition, any gun that was adopted by the Soviets, 100 years ago, and ammo was made, you know, continuously during that time, probably a good bet that those guns are going to continue. They're still in service, service around the world. And so it's continued supply of ammo, but whether it's going to be affordable or not is another consideration.
Well, that's the key. That's the key. Now, I think in the last show you talked a little bit about a pistol your dad had, which I think was a 1911 built in the 40s or something like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, amongst the guns that my dad owned that I can remember as a kid, being duped into learning how to clean it so that, you know, that would be forever my duty, the old M1911 A1 was probably my favorite gun, the one that I kind of cherished the most of the guns that my dad owned when I was a kid.
And you've shot that in competition, haven't you?
Yeah, it was actually, although today, you know, I think people cringe, myself included, when you see an old military pistol that had previously been in good condition that's been converted into a shooter, its collectability gone due to modifications. That's something that's 20, 25 years ago, you know, people didn't consider, you know, a surplus pistol. It was just an old gun, you know, if it could serve as the basis for something useful, then it was worthwhile. And today, that gun that when my dad had it back in, 30 years ago, and it was worth $400 or $500, if it were in the same condition today that it was then, it'd probably be worth $1,500 or $2,000. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in my wisdom, you know, I had a trigger job done on it and had the sights changed and stuff so I could actually shoot it. And it certainly increased my enjoyment of shooting it, but at the same time, you know, pretty much destroyed the value of it.
Well, what do you think of this? I have a friend of mine that has an old CZ-52 chambered in 7.62 by 25. What do you think of those?
Well, that's a cartridge that I think the ammo is still fairly readily available at reasonable prices.
That's right. Yeah, it's pretty cheap. Fairly easy to reload for it, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, and I think it's a gun that, you know, I've read some stuff about it. I'm not that familiar with it. You know, Czechoslovakian service pistol, probably plenty durable. I suspect it was it's been around long enough that there should be, you know, some parts on the surplus market and whatnot. I'd say if you're looking for an inexpensive center fire, plinker, you know, maybe doing some double duty as a defense weapon, it's probably not a bad way to go.
It's a heck of a hot round. It's, I mean, that thing's a hand cannon. Supposedly, I guess, they said at one time it was able to penetrate body armor. I'm not so sure about that, but it's just, it's an extremely powerful round.
Yeah, and somewhat unfortunately, it's dimensionally, externally, it's dimensionally the same as the old 30 caliber Mauser round for which the old broom handle Mausers were chambered. Mm-hmm. And if you get those mixed up, you put the Czech ammo in a 100-year-old Mauser broom handle, you might reduce it to a pile of junk.
I didn't know that. Hey, since we're talking about Mausers, what do you think of 8mm Mausers?
I've never owned one, but I know a guy who's more of a rifle buff than I am, and he's bought a couple of, you'll see these ads in especially the trade magazines advertising, you know, like these are the last of the, you know, they're either, they've got Nazi markings on them or they were made in arsenals in Yugoslavia during World War II. And so they've got a little bit of, you know, the cachet of being associated with the German military. And the prices still seem pretty reasonable. And, you know, an 8mm Mauser is another round that not only was a military round for many, many years, but it has also been loaded on the commercial market in the U.S. for many years. So you're not dependent on a supply of imported ammo. So the 8mm Mauser is an interesting cartridge because it was so widely used for so long. I mean, the Germans used it as their service cartridge for years and years, and then the other European countries followed suit. So they're at least at one time was a large supply of surplus ammo, but then it's also been loaded as a sporting cartridge in the U.S. So I think the combination of the strength and enduring kind of popularity and legend of the Mauser action and the popularity of the 8mm cartridge, it's, you know, I don't think you can go wrong with that as long as the rifle is in good shootable condition.
I love that Mauser action.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, I mean, I've got a 1903 Springfield, which was deemed at the time the U.S. military adopted it to be close enough to the Model 98 Mauser that the U.S. government had to pay royalties to the German government for every Springfield rifle they made.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, you look at so many of the bolt-action rifles of that era, early 20th century, you know, late 19th, early 20th century, you had features of the Mauser action, and, you know, even today, sporting rifles, you know, they'll refer to the Mauser-style extractor and whatnot, and it's still kind of the, you know, I don't know that you can, different guns have been made that were different, but I don't know how much better they are in terms of the bolt-action style.
Yeah, my dad had an 8mm Mauser. He brought it back from Germany when he got out of the military, and my mom has it now. She won't let me have it, I think, because it's in phenomenal shape. I think she knows the value of it.
Right.
She doesn't want to let me have it.
Right.
Plus, it's kind of a sentimental thing. You know, my dad passed away, and it was one of the guns that he acquired when he was in the military. So I think more so than anything, it's a sentimental gun that my mom won't let me have.
Well, that's probably good reason then.
Yeah, I'm sure one of these days, either me or my brothers will end up, you know, getting it. But that's why I brought that up. So to collectibles again, you know, we touched a little bit on this subject the last time you were on the show. But if somebody wants to start acquiring older guns, where do you think they ought to start?
They should start at the library.
Ooh, good answer.
Yeah, I mean, you really need to do your homework. I know as certain guns become more popular and more valuable, you find more research available, and then as the research reveals differences in, you know, you'll find what, like, I remember as a kid reading these old gun magazines from the 60s where they would list the surplus weapons they had available for sale, and their Luger ad would say, "We have both types." Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, I remember in the 70s when Guns and Ammo magazine had a monthly Luger column. I mean, collecting Lugers was popular enough that they had a Luger editor that wrote a monthly column. And every month they would talk about, oh, you know, they found a new variation, you know, and it's identifiable by, you know, some obscure little detail. And I thought, you know, 10 years earlier, people were selling guns, you know, they had the 4-inch barrel and they had the 6-inch barrel. You know, we have both types. And, you know, now we've got Navy Lugers and artillery Lugers and commercial models, military models. And I think as stuff becomes better known through research, more people can get interested. It's more accessible as stuff gets printed, published, posted on the internet. I guess, you know, that's maybe not as authoritative as the printed page, but, you know, I was trying to look up information on various guns, and there's just so much more information out there. And so if you're going to spend any money, especially, you know, if you want some kind of a return on your investment, I mean, if you look at a collectible gun as something you really think you want it to appreciate, you really got to do your homework. And so I'd say, you know, find who's the authority, buy their book. If there's a collector organization, join that, you know, so you've got that kind of resource available. And just be very careful. I mean, as gun values go up, there's more and more stuff getting faked, and it could be kind of a minefield.
What authorities have you read or listened to?
Well, I've bought a couple of books when I was really interested in the M1911 and M1911A1 pistol. The authority that everybody quotes is a guy named Clausen. Mm-hmm. I also bought a book that's by a guy named Goddard. They've got access to government records, you know, patent dates and serial number ranges and just, you know, sharp photographs. I mean, that's the other thing. If you can find an example of what the thing is supposed to look like and get some good photographs of it, then that helps everybody else determine if what they're holding in their hand is original or if it's been faked or modified.
Rick, when you get a chance, could you look up a link to those books and email it to me?
Yeah, sure.
I'll put those in the show notes for people that might want to get those.
Yeah, I think Clausen's book is out of print and fairly pricey. I mean, I see it on the 1911 forum, fairly pricey. But I think the Goddard book you can get it from, you know, Amazon. So,
hey, let's talk 1911s for a minute, since you're a 1911 shooter and you seem to know a lot about them. Do you have a 1911 that was built in 1911?
I have one that was built in 1918.
Oh, that's right. You talked about that on the last show.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, you know, in terms of numbers produced, I think Colt made more 1911 style pistols during calendar year 1918 than any other year. And they made more certainly in 1918 than they did between 1911 and 1918. And then production fell off, way off again in the 20s and 30s. There were so many, you know, hundreds of thousands of them made during World War One, that they didn't need very many in the interwar period. And then, of course, production ramped up again in the early 40s.
Okay. Okay, cool. I think you said last time you also have a muzzleloader, right?
I have an old musket, an old Springfield Armory musket that the history of it is somewhat shrouded in, you know, mystery, because my mother, as a little girl, knew her great-grandfather, who was a Civil War veteran. And when she was, you know, 7 years old, he was 97 years old. And I have an old Springfield musket that came from that side of the family, but we have no way of determining whether that was the actual service weapon issued to the great-great-grandfather, or if it's something he picked up at a flea market, you know, 50 years later. I don't know, but I try to preserve it as if it's the real thing.
Have you shot it?
No. It had actually been demilled somewhat roughly with a hacksaw, I think, cut the nipple off percussion cap fits on. And I've subsequently had a replacement nipple put on it. Somebody drilled out the old one and put another one in, just kind of a cosmetic replacement so the hammer would have something to rest on. But when I put a string down the bore, with a weight on the end of it. It fell about 3 inches short of going all the way to the back of the where the breech end of the barrel should be. So there's 3 inches of something in the bottom of the barrel at the breech end. And I don't know if it's loaded or, you know, it sits on the mantle, and I occasionally will take it down and, you know, wipe it off, but it just kind of sits there on the mantle.
I don't blame you. It's a great conversation piece.
Yeah, it is.
Well, one more question before I let you go, because I want to keep this episode actually kind of brief, because I got another interview that I'm going to actually put into this same episode. But what do you think of guns, handguns that some people actually like to conceal carry, like Makarovs?
I think it's a matter of the selection should be up to the person who's making the choice and what their considerations are. I mean, if you're looking at something, you want a gun that's fairly concealable, fairly inexpensive, ammunition that's, you know, somewhat available. I mean, I can think of a worse gun, but it's personally, I would shy away from something that was not kind of a mainstream American design, just for the reason that you'd want access to parts and services and ammo. I mean, obviously there's 9x18 ammo available on the U.S. commercial market. You're not dependent on, you know, Eastern European ammunition manufacturers. But if that's the gun you have, then it's certainly a good choice. But I wouldn't seek out a gun like that. In preference to something a little more mainstream.
What about some old revolvers?
Well, revolvers, the thing that's interesting is a brand new revolver is just made 100 years later than an old revolver.
You know, same style.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about it today on the bus ride home. I had one of the few guns I bought that probably was a collector's item was an old Colt Army Special, which was a 38, kind of a medium frame 38 revolver that with a name change became the Colt Official Police, which was, you know, on the hip of every cop in the United States for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And it was just a beautiful gun. I decided in my own mind that it was probably unfired. And so I sold it, hoping that somebody who would not be tempted, you know, that their ultimate joy would be to see it sitting in a case, that they would have it and enjoy it that way rather than me having it and being tempted to shoot it. But, I bought a Smith & Wesson revolver 2 or 3 years ago, and mechanically it's almost identical to the revolver that my grandfather owned that had been owned by his uncle prior to that. I mean, it's kind of a timeless design. And, you know, if you've got one that's in good shape, especially if it's, you know, made, say, since World War II, you know, a lot of the guns' metallurgy improved and whatnot in the post-war years. And so, you know, if you've got a Colt Detective Special that was made in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s, you know, it's going to be, I certainly wouldn't avoid using something like that if that's what I had available.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some manufacturers trying to reinvent the revolver, like Ruger with their new LCR.
Yeah, I shot one of those in .357 Magnum, and it was a distinctly, I can't imagine it would be much less pleasant on the receiving end than it was for the shooter.
Well, you know, I don't know if you listened to the show that James Kimmerly, my shooting friend, and I did on the Ruger LCR a couple of months ago. We rented one of those in .38 Special. I wasn't all that impressed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thought it was pretty neat. It was pretty neat and handy. I mean, if I were going to buy something like that, I mean, a small compact pistol, I'd probably be more likely to get something like a traditional, like a J-frame Smith & Wesson. But if you like, you know, kind of the modern materials and the advantages of modern manufacturing processes and stuff, I thought the LCR was kind of a neat little gun. But again, not in .357.
So you didn't like the .357 version of it, huh?
Not at all.
What didn't you like about it? Was it just, I mean, was it too brutal or what?
Oh, yeah, a little too much shock and awe for me.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, which, you know, and I know we're getting a little bit off topic here on old guns, but since you brought that up, you know, one of the challenges I have with snubby revolvers in .357, and I hope I don't get a bunch of hate mail from revolver lovers, you know, they're just so unpleasant to shoot that people don't want to practice with them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and obviously, you know, I think if you're going to practice with it, you probably could get away with shooting a bunch of 38s out of it and then just finish up with a few, you know, even if it was just one cylinder full of 357, just so that if and when you had to shoot the thing, you wouldn't be surprised by the noise and the recoil. Although I've also heard that when the balloon goes up, you're not likely to notice the recoil and the blast. You're going to be, your mind is going to be occupied with other more important things.
And that's probably very true, which is why, you know, before I start getting a bunch of negative comments, folks, you know, okay, if that's your gun, if that's your type of gun, it's a good one to carry, okay?
Yeah, right. Better that you have that one than that you don't have one.
Exactly. Better to have that than nothing at all. Absolutely. And I certainly would never, ever want to be on the receiving end of a 357. No way.
Right.
No, not at all. So, all right, Rick, thanks for coming on the show and talking some more about
sure.
old guns. Any final thoughts before I let you go?
I'm going to make a greater effort to listen to your show, for sure, in the future. I mean, Steve, you know, told me, oh, you know, I've been on the show a few times, listened to it, and, you know, I listened to a couple of episodes that he's been on, but I intend to listen in more in depth, because I see, just based on some of the topics and stuff I see on the forum, that there's some good stuff on there.
I do my best, you know, and I get interesting people like you on here and everybody else who's been on this show, so that kind of, you know, makes it a little bit more interesting for a lot of folks. And as you know, I try to do some interviews when I'm out at the shooting range with people and things like that, so
mm-hmm.
I don't want people to just listen to me talk all the time, because everybody who's ever listened to me talk all the time, family members included, they start saying, okay, Bob, enough already.
Yeah.
Especially when I start talking about guns, you know, it's hard for me to stop.
Right, exactly.
So, well, thanks, Rick, for coming on. Again, folks, this is Rick Brenneman. Rick Brenneman has joined me. He's from the Power Factor Show. A lot of good information on collecting older guns, and I appreciate that, Rick. Thanks a lot.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
All right, you too.
Bye. All right, good stuff. Rick, I know you're listening. Thanks very much for coming on the show. Next, let's go ahead and get Steve Zofie on here. Now, you know, obviously both of these were pre-recorded in advance, but not too long ago. I usually do this stuff about a week or so in advance. That's typically about it. But Steve and I talked about how do they score all those targets and everything, and how do you get classified if you're in IDPA or USPSA and so forth. I'm going to play the first 15 minutes of my interview. Now, we did almost an hour interview. We even talked about sandbagging and grand bagging and things like that, and we got into some of the nuances of how some people game it and why you shouldn't game it. And why you should, you know, go at it as if it's a competition and it's fun and games, but don't necessarily quite be a gamer. So the rest of the interview, you'll be able to hear on version 2 of my upcoming Shooters Club CD or digital download. So let me just take a quick minute to talk about that. A few announcements I want to talk about as well. Version 2, I should have released pretty much about a week after you hear this podcast, pretty much right around the 1st of March or so, maybe a little bit earlier. I'm going to have a whole bunch of more information put together on concealed carry, self-defense. I got another interview coming up about self-defense skills, and especially self-defense skills for females. So that's coming up, and that's going to be on the next version of the CD or digital download. I like to put out some exclusive information for people who support this show. So if you want to get the rest of this interview and everything else that I've got on there on version number 2, it's only an investment of $15, folks. Now, as you know, until March 15th, I'm donating 50% of the money that I raise from these downloads to the Second Amendment Foundation, a very aggressive organization that's fighting the legal battle to help preserve our gun rights. So I'm going to give them half of the money. If you want it in CD form, I can do that. I can burn a CD and send it to you. Typically, what 95% of the people are doing is once they make the investment, I just send them an email with instructions to download it so you can put it right on your iPod or MP3 player or your computer. Just go to handgunworld.com. That's the website where I publish this podcast, handgunworld.com. Click the Shooters Club CD link, or you can just click the Buy Now button and reserve your copy, because I'm going to be releasing it, as I mentioned, somewhere right around the 15th of March, or excuse me, right around the 1st of March. Now, also, don't forget to join me on the forums at the Gun Rights Radio Network. Just go to gunrightsradio.com, click the forum tab. It'll take you to where you want to go. Get signed up. Good people on that forum. I also have a YouTube channel. Probably by the time you hear this, I'll have a new video uploaded. So check me out on YouTube, Handgun World Show on YouTube. You can check me out on Facebook, same title, Handgun World Show. Shooters Legion is another great networking site. That's shooterslegion.com, and I've got a page on there also called Handgun World Show, and my Twitter account. You can see all of the resources and links. Folks, there's no excuse to not be able to interact with me and get a hold of me if you want. And I love comments, I love feedback, I love constructive criticism, and I really like questions. So please take advantage of today's modern technology and get a hold of me. So here you go. Here comes Steve Zofie. We're going to talk a little bit about the scoring system in competition shooting, and I'll be right back when that interview is over. Stay tuned. Don't go away.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking with just a little flight information. Coming up on the left, we're going to be catching a glimpse of the Grand Canyon. On the right, you can be able to see the Hoover Dam in just a few minutes. We're flying at an altitude of 37,000 feet, and our airspeed is 400 miles an hour. Couple little facts here. I'm packing a Colt King Cobra. That's a 357 caliber firearm with a black rubber grip and a 6-inch barrel. Also, the co-pilot is carrying a Kimber custom defense pistol with all the bells and whistles you'd expect from a custom gun of that kind, with an alloy frame and bevel treatment on the entire gun. And our chief flight attendant, Roger, has a Ruger Bearcat 22 with a hand-fluted cylinder. All three are capable of piercing body armor at a distance of up to 27 feet, and it can put a hole in human bone and flesh the size of the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, is coming up on the left-hand side of the plane, so just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the flight.
Okay, for the main topic, guess what? I got Steve Zofie back on the line with me. How you doing, Steve?
Very good, Bob. Hey, by the way, congratulations on your Cheeseheads winning the Super Bowl.
Hey, how about that, huh? How about that? The Lombardi Trophy is going back home to where it rightly belongs.
Right, right.
But, you know, hey, Seattle did pretty well this year.
They did all right. Seattle has, I mean, it's funny. They've not had the greatest season, overall. And I think a lot of people had said before, I'm not real big on football. Baseball's my thing.
Yeah.
But Seattle's record was, I think, well below 500. In fact, they said even if they went to the point of winning the Super Bowl, they would have been at just breaking even at a 500 season, which
would.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's almost pathetic. I mean, the teams that are going to the Super Bowl should be the ones that are, you know, just dominating your league. And if some team came along and won the Super Bowl with a 500 record, I mean, that's embarrassing in my mind. But
it kind of makes you wonder if the system's a little bit screwy. But, that was interesting. It was just kind of cool. I thought it was kind of cool to actually see someone with a losing record and see what they could do. And I was impressed that they pulled that first game off.
Yeah, I think a lot of people actually were surprised they pulled that first game off, to be honest. I mean, they were beating teams that they probably shouldn't have beat. St. Louis should have definitely taken care of Seattle in that first game, but at any rate.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thanks for that sentiment of congratulations. So we're going to talk about the competition classification system. And, this was Steve's idea to talk about this. And, Steve, I'm glad you brought this up, because I've actually been getting a lot of emails, you know, from people asking me, how do they figure those scores, what goes into it, and how do you get classified? So
right.
Why don't you start by talking a little bit about how you get classified?
Okay, well, we can talk first off from IDPA, and then we can talk from USPSA. And IDPA side, you may have to help me along here, because while I've done it before, it's not my my main gig, so to speak. So
sure.
In IDPA, they have a designated classifier, course of fire. They call it the classifier. And I think it's roughly 90 rounds. It's made up of, I think, what they kind of define as three different stages. And you score all three, and that creates your final score for the whole entire classifier.
That's correct.
And basically the first stage is kind of like static shooting. You're not really moving. I think the second stage is a lot of, you know, either moving forward or retreating. And then the third stage has to do with, I think, a barricade and a barrel. And I think you have a little bit of forward movement or something like that there. But basically it's kind of testing the shooter's skill at speed, testing it at movement, and testing it at accuracy. That kind of defines the first, second, and the third stage. Mm-hmm. So after a shooter goes and does that, there is a basically a lookup table, if you will, that based on the division that they're shooting in, and divisions again being like CDP, ESP, stock service pistol, and then the two revolver divisions, there is a ranking there for marksman, which is the bottom, and then master, which is the top. And they have a time, and you take your total time from the classifier, and your total time from the classifier is basically your total time plus points, or a half a second for, I believe it's a half a second for each point down that you are. They sum all that up, and that's your final score. You go to that chart, you look up, you see where you are, and it defines you as being, you know, a certain classified shooter in that division that you're shooting.
Yeah. And, okay. Let me stop you right there for just a second.
Sure.
While you were talking there, I just Googled the IDPA matrix there that shows the different divisions. So for all the listeners listening to this, I will put a link in the show notes to where you can go straight to that table and look to see what the times are to classify for each of the different divisions.
That would be good. And also, you might consider linking the, I think they have there also, because I looked this up, but the IDPA classifier course of fire. So it shows you, there's a drawing that they have with all the targets of what height they are and what distance they are. And then there's also a designation of the different stage one, stage two, stage three. So you can kind of see what the drill is for each individual stage.
Okay, so now how's it done? USPSA is the same thing, right? You show up for a – no, actually, you don't have a classifier, do you?
No, it's really different. And so in USPSA, there are roughly 100, maybe even more than that now, 100 different what's designated as classifier courses of fire. So one might argue that the USPSA method might be a little more representative of a shooter's skill, because – they don't really, I mean, the IDPA classifier course of fire, you know what it is. You know what each thing is, and you can literally go out and practice it. You can drill this thing over and over and over and practice each little section of it until you become really good. And then you go, okay, now that I've done this, I'm going to go out and shoot the classifier. And a lot of the clubs will end up having like a classifier match or something like that. But you know what you're practicing for, and you can practice for it. In USPSA, it's different in that there are roughly 100 different classifier courses of fire, and typically every club match they'll randomly pick a classifier, and the shooters don't know what it is in advance, or typically don't know what it is in advance, so they can't really go practice anything. In USPSA, the way they do it is that you shoot the course of fire, and you get a hit factor. Now, hit factor, like we've discussed before, is nothing more than your points divided by your time. So your points for that course of fire divided by your time for it yields your hit factor. Mm-hmm. So now that you have a hit factor, that number is then submitted to the USPSA. And there's what's called a high hit factor number. For every single classifier has a unique high hit factor number for it. They basically take your score as a ratio or a percentage of that high hit factor, and that's your score for that particular classifier. So as an example, if the high hit factor for the course of fire was 10 and you shot 8, you would get 80, which would be basically an A class, or what's defined as an A class score for that course of fire.
Okay.
And now in USPSA, what happens then is that if you haven't shot, or if you're unclassified in a division, you haven't shot any classifiers in that division, after you shoot your first four, you're given your classification. And then after you have adopted or received a given classification in a division, it's your best six of your last eight. So
that's how that works.
Yeah, they toss out your two lowest scores, and they take your other best six, they average it out of all of them, and that becomes your score, basically your ranking nationally. Now, the way they develop the high hit factor is done kind of one of two that I know of different ways. One way is they will have – what the idea is, they have to have – what they're trying to do is get the best shooters in the country. So we're talking like Rob Latham and Todd Jarrett and Dave Savigny and people of that skill level, grandmasters basically. Mm-hmm. to shoot the course of fire and submit their score, and then they take kind of the average of those runs, and that's how they develop the high hit factor. So sometimes what they do is they'll come up with brand new courses of fire that haven't been shot, and to my understanding, they will then have, like, you know, Robbie and those types of people shoot them, submit their numbers, turn them back in, and come up with a unique number for that course of fire, for that class fire, to develop the high hit factor. The other way that it's done is that they will submit or include the stage in a major match, like an area championship or maybe even the nationals or something to that effect. So at that point, that course of fire is not a classifier by definition yet, but it will become a classifier after the match is done, where they take all the shooters' scores. Again, they're looking for big name shooters who are there at the match who do very well. And they use that, they're kind of like their combined scores to develop the hit factor for that classifier.
Well, that's quite a bit different than the way IDPA does it. Yeah.
It is. Yeah, very different. So in IDPA, they have a number, and the question then is, well, how do they come up with those numbers that they use to define the different class shooters? My guess is, and somebody can probably contact you if I'm wrong, but my guess is it's probably done very similar. They probably take, you know, the master class shooters are some of the best shooters in the game, and basically have them shoot the classifier course of fire, and then kind of come up with a baseline there, saying, well, based on this person's, you know, known skill level, we think that, you know, the master time should be between here and whatever, and so on and so forth. So it's done similar but different. In the IDPA, obviously, we have one course. IPSC or USPSA, we have multiple courses. In IDPA, obviously, your score is just your single classifier that you shot, where in USPSA, it's a combination of a bunch of different classifiers that you shot.
Okay. So that's interesting. I didn't know there was that many differences between USPSA and and IDPA. I'm going to have to get reclassified, by the way, in USPSA pretty soon. So I need to get out and start shooting probably a half a dozen matches and kind of get that underway.
Yeah, typically... at least up here where I'm at in the Northwest section, every club includes a classifier in their monthly match. And up here you can shoot USPSA every weekend if you wish. So you can, you know, get a lot of classifiers under your belt. Now, the other thing to sometimes look for in terms of USPSA is what's called a special classifier match. And that's kind of like hopefully a one-stop classification deal where you go to the match and they have maybe four or six classifier courses of fire. So literally the whole entire match is made up of classifiers. And you go there, and assuming you do okay, and you don't blow any of the classifiers, then you'll pretty much instantly become classified at that match. Now, when I say don't blow any of the classifiers, USPSA basically says that if you score less than 2% on a classifier, then they don't include it. So if you basically to score less than 2%, you probably have to get more penalty points than you've got scoring points on a given course of fire. In other words, zeroing it. Yeah, if you zero it, you're not going to get anything. Now, also the USPSA kind of does something that's interesting. When you submit let's say you shoot a classifier and you turn the score in, if the classifier is more than 5%, less than your division that you're in, they don't include it. So if you have a bad run on a classifier, you know, let's say, so I'm a master class shooter. If I shoot anything that is, I believe, so a master is 85 and up. So if I shoot anything that's less than 80, they don't include it. So it doesn't hurt against, or doesn't count toward or against me. The other flip side of that is that if you shoot what they say 15% above your classification, they think, okay, well, maybe something wasn't set up right, or this is an anomaly or something like that. So they may not include it. More often than not, they probably would. But if they think that things are just so far, like if you're a C-class shooter and you go off and you shoot like a 90% or a 95% or 100% on a classifier, they may look at that and go, boy, that's so far out of his category. You know, it's well more than 15% above the top level of a C-class shooter that they just decide to discard it and not use it at all.
Ah, didn't know that either.
So because of that, the classification system is somewhat what we refer to as upward mobile. In other words, it's kind of once you get a certain classification, it's kind of difficult to go down because of the fact that they throw out anything that's more than 5% below your classification. And it kind of, because of the way the system's set up, it will generally kind of try to push you more up than it will go down. You can go down slightly, but generally speaking, you won't go down by much. The problem with that is that it sets up a mindset in shooters. And it's basically, and we've talked about this before, when you shoot, you should shoot and be aggressive when you shoot, be assertive, but you don't want to go at 120% above your skill level. So the problem is that shooters will go into classifiers and they'll say, okay, now I'm going to turn it up, because if I blow the classifier, it's not going to hurt me, but if I do really well, it's going to bump me up. So they go out and they go all out, and they may get lucky and they may end up shooting a really, really good run. But then you ask the question, is that really representative of their on-demand skill? I mean, could they go into a match and be able to pull that off, or did they just get lucky? And more often than not, they just got lucky in what they did. So to a certain degree, that hurts the shooter, because all of a sudden now they go off and let's say their approach is, every time they hit a class four, I'm going to shoot at 120%. Well, eventually, after doing this, they're going to end up being classified a lot higher than what their true representative skill level is. And for some, and for some people, unfortunately, they like to say, I'm a master class shooter, I'm an A class shooter, when in reality, their on-demand performance is not at that level. So it hurts them.
Yeah, and you know, it's similar in IDPA. You know, you mentioned you wanted to talk about grand bagging and sandbagging. You know, you mentioned earlier in this discussion that there are people who will practice that classifier over and over and over again, and they'll get real good at it. So they'll show up and they may classify as expert, but when they actually get out there and shoot a match and they have to navigate a course of fire, they have to figure out what to do and when to do it and how to maximize their time and minimize their motion and so forth, and the pressure hits them and the buzzer goes off and all that, it's a lot different than static shooting.
Very true. So we actually, okay, so now that you've raised that point, we have three different things that we can discuss here: the grand bagging and sandbagging, which you touched on, and then the last point that you touched on there is basically a representation of the shooter's skill level or skill set. So we'll leave grand bagging and sandbagging here for a minute, but let's talk about that.
Okay, many thanks to Steve. Appreciate that very much. Anytime somebody wants to come on this show, if you've got an area of expertise as it relates to shooting, concealed carry, self-defense, gun maintenance, gun selection, things like that, please just email me. I can either call you up on the phone, or if you have Skype, we can do a Skype-to-Skype interview. I'd love to bring you on the show. Now, if you do invest in my digital download, during the rest of that interview, me and Steve get into stuff like our self-defense guns and what we carry and what calibers and why, and practicing with your self-defense guns and how competition shooting will help you or hurt you with your self-defense guns and self-defense training needs and things like that. So, you know, we kind of get off the subject of competition shooting for a while and just kind of shoot the breeze about guns. And I got to tell you, when we shoot the breeze about guns, we got into some interesting stuff. Let me just put it that way, and I'll just leave it at that. So that's it, folks. I hope you had a good listen here this week on the show. And thanks again for downloading and listening. My name is Bob Main. You've just listened to another episode of the Handgun World Show. And the reason I carry a gun is very, very simple, folks. Because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for tuning in. Safe shooting, and I'll catch you next time.
Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan. Guns and money.